Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week we embrace the spirit of Northern Soul with Soul Boy, a film that celebrates the dynamism of the Wigan Casino and Northern England's love of soul music. And I meet the Soul Boy himself, Martin Compston, talks high kicks and hip swings. And although we do our best not to let spoilers creep into Film Weekly, there is one cat that we've got to let out of the bag. Secret Cinema is reinventing how we watch the classics here in the UK. I'll be talking to its founder, Fabian Riggle, about his attempt to reinvent the mystery and magic of cinema. Yes, it's sweeter than finding a rare 45 in a car boot sale. It's Film Weekly. The term Northern Soul may have been coined to help Wigan football fans find specialist soul tracks in the legendary Covent Garden record shop Soul City, but by the mid-70s, the term was a byword for clubbing at its best, from the catacombs in Wolverhampton to the legendary Wigan Casino. The youth of Northern England reinvigorated a global passion for rare soul combined with athletic moves on the dance floor, and Northern Soul is still alive and high-kicking to this very day, so it's no surprise that a film like Soul Boy should set out to capture this unique youth subculture and its particular buzz. Rising Scottish star Martin Compston plays the lead role of Joe McCann, a young man bored at work who discovers the simple pleasures of great music and the torment of young love.
So what's the twisted wheel?
You'll be cracking on your no notes about Wigan next. The club? The wheel was a soul club in Manchester. The should it said people were having too much fun.
From Wigan.
Opened last year, too to late. No divvies allowed.
Might see you there then.
Stranger things happen.
Groovy.
I'm sitting with Martin Compston in a classic rock cafe in New Burlington Street. I've got Miles Davis, Led Zepp, Iggy Pop on the walls. And it's kind of apt because, you know, this film that you're in, Martin, Soul Boy, really taps into one of Britain's great unsung musical genres and movement.
Yeah. No, I mean, the Northern Soul scene was an incredible scene. You know, it was a sort of, I think it was a unique time in sort of British subculture, you know, and but it was a complete and utter way of life for some people, you know, all the different faucets to it, the record dealing, the dancing, you know, the just the whole thing, and people are really obsessed by it. And
did you know about it growing up in Scotland?
I didn't, but again, it's, you know, it was going on in Stoke, where we actually filmed, in Manchester, before it came to its sort of mecca, which was in Wigan. But from knowing that, people were hitchhiking down from Elgin, and Inverness, and down from Portsmouth and Plymouth to get there. You know, it was, you know, people were really into it, you know, and you can see why. It's just, the music really is incredible.
Tell us a little bit about your character in it.
Joe is just bored, you know, he's just, has no excitement in his life. He's at the same kind of dingy pub every weekend, same sort of rubbish, same routine, and he just finds this other world, which is just exciting, you know, and it's, it was fashion, you know, he'd just never seen anything like it before. And I think all people can relate to that. And because I hate people saying the term, "You've got, that's a job for life." I mean, who wants a job for a life when they're a teenager? Who wants their life mapped out for them, you know? And it's just, I think a lot of people can relate to that.
I couldn't help think of you, actually, Martin. The first time I met you at Sweet 16 in Cannes, all those years ago. And you didn't want your job. You weren't even sure you were going to be an actor. You still wanted to play for Greenock. You still wanted to be a footballer. You didn't want your life mapped out. It looks now, I've got to say, I'm really pleased to see that you have decided for acting.
No, I mean, I've always kind of loved acting. It was something I just never took it serious as a career. Even at Cannes with Sweet 16, I thought, this is going to last a couple of minutes, and this is going to be it, and it's going to be over. And my first love was football, and it's what I always wanted to do. But, I mean, I think you've got to be quite brutal with yourself, and I wasn't good enough, I think, to ever do it all. If I could have run out at Celtic Park, I'd give it all up now and go be a football player. But I don't think I was that good. So,
just looking at it, but looking at you now and knowing you since Sweet 16, all those years, I think you would have been into Northern Soul if you were alive.
I think, no, I really would have. But I mean, it's just, it's kind of weird because it was sort of like early breakdancing, and it was just funny to look at this thing of these working class lads, and a lot of the dancing came from early martial arts, so they're really tough boys, whereas now dancing's kind of associated maybe with a bit something that's not exactly a hard man image. But these guys were really, you know, tough boys, and just going and doing this incredible spinning and flips and splits, you know, and they were in their own little world. It's great.
You've obviously not only studied the music and the subculture, which is what I really like the film, because it's a great little area to go into as a subculture, because you get the fashion, you get the kind of social history of it. You've obviously studied the physical dance history of this. How is that what you did to try and get into the part? Is that what you had to learn as part of the choreography?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was terrifying when I saw the original footage, and because I was just attracted to the script. I didn't know anything about the actual dancing. When I saw the documentary of the original dancing, you know, it really was terrifying, thinking I have to try and do that. And at the same time, I had to be realistic. I mean, I had a month prep, and you're not, it would be disrespectful to think you were going to become an expert northern dancer, because it takes years and years of dancing like that. But I was very lucky to have a guy called Keb Darge, who's was sort of one of the legends of the scene, you know, dancing. He's still a DJ, and a lovely guy called Liam Quinn. And they taught me to dance, you know, and they are so enthusiastic. I mean, there was a lot of times it was like bang your head against the wall thinking, I'm not going to get this. But they never let my head drop, and they just kept up at it. And hopefully I got there in the end.
Yes, I thought I was pretty impressed. I was like, I didn't know Compton could dance. The boy can move.
I didn't know I could dance either.
I've seen you at parties in Cannes. You couldn't dance.
I know, but I was probably a bit more under the influence in Cannes.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. When you do a film that is about subculture, you've got to get that subculture right. And that's kind of why you're on the show, because I think that the film really nailed that. It managed to weave that archive footage in so nicely with the kind of modern footage. That was really part of the attraction of the film to be. Plus, it was very faithful to the dance and the music and the talcum powder, the costume. They seemed to get that right first, and I think that's probably the right way if you're doing a film so precious to so many people.
Well, I mean, it's at the same time, you know, it was the art guys and the costume. They did a great job, you know, and it was a great touch to mix in some of the original footage, because it just gives it that authentic feel. But at the same time, you know, we had to have an artistic license, and there's some things we did there for film purposes which would never have happened. You know, just a bit more light thing gives the film a bit of a climax. And because I remember when I was filming it, I became myself quite obsessed with the scene and how it really was, and I wanted to make it as real as possible, because this was people's lives. This was the epitome of their youth, and you want to make it as true as possible. So there's bits I was going like, I can't do this. This would have never happened. And Shimmy, our director, would just have to rein me and go, look, mate, if you don't do this, you don't have a job. We'd be as well making a documentary. Well, you're here to make a film. Yeah. So there's a bit that I think where it is as true as possible, but there's other bits where I think it's a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, well, you've woven in a kind of coming-of-age story into it. You know, to be honest, a lot of people came of age at the Wigan Casino, or at least on the bus journeys to and from.
No, because, I mean, there was people. I hear stories of people sneaking out their back windows, at 14 to hitchhike from Glasgow and stuff, you know, and it's like, can you imagine trying to do that now? You know, it was just a different time.
Now, obviously the music is brilliant. Your film has got a soundtrack going to it, and actually it's brilliant, because whenever you do go for a movie, am I going to get clearance rights for these? Yeah. Obviously with Northern Soul, one of the great joys of it, the music itself was kind of unpublished. It was cheap at the time. You managed to get some really good stuff there. Have you got any favourite artists, songs that you've discovered through this film?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I think one people really know is the original Tainted Love was an original Northern, and the original was so much better than how many times
Gloria Jones.
But I mean, it's been done so many times by
Soft Cell was
it? It's nothing compared to the original. When you hear the original, that's the way it should have been done, you know. And Fatboy Slim, who's remixed loads of northern tunes, but again, I think it's because he was so influenced by it. I mean, but there's a couple of tunes that I really love, but we've got a soundtrack album coming out, which I think is the first one I've ever had in a film, and it's myself and Felicity and Nicola on the front, so I feel like I've got an album coming out. It feels pretty good.
You're a pop star now.
Yeah, well, I'm a northern star.
Exactly. Well, that's much cooler. Where can we see you next? I know Soul Boy's only just out, and I don't want to bring your night at the partying at the Wigan Casino to an end, but where can we see you next? What other projects? Because, I mean, you've done a bit of Hollywood as well.
Yeah, I mean, things have been going all right over there. You know, Saints, a film I did over there with, you know, Shia LaBeouf and Channing Tatum and Robert Downey Jr. You know, it's a good calling card for me over there. But I've got a film, probably it's called Ghosted, which is
a guide to recognising yourself.
Yeah, that was the kind of
Dito Montiel.
Yeah, Dito. I mean, Dito's last film was Pacino. You know what I mean? So he's doing all right. But my next film out over here will be a thing called Ghosted with John Lynch and Art Malik and David Schofield and Craig Parkinson, and probably emotionally, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, it was a real, real challenge. But hopefully it's all right. So that should be out later this year sometime.
Well, it's lovely to see you growing up on screen and becoming really, really good, because in Soul Boy you kind of anchored it and nailed it. It's a difficult role. It could have gone wrong, and I think you did it brilliantly. And you look... Did you get any of those costumes? What have you kept?
I really wanted the jacket, but I think somebody's pinched it.
Not even the little goal in the bag.
Somebody stole that as well. I mean, fair play, because the extras were really really working hard for us and stuff, so I think one of them has nicked it.
Martin Compson's vest on eBay would go for a fortune. A drop of sweat from the man himself. Mate, lovely to see you.
Thank you. Things right, you need someone to hold you tight,
and who think love is to play. Oh, yeah, excuse me, just wiping myself down with my towel. The brilliant Gloria Jones with the original version of Tainted Love there. As Martin Compton said, it cannot be matched. Soul Boy is out this Friday, the 3rd of September here in the UK. And we've got two of those soundtracks for you to win. All you've got to do is answer the simple question, post it on our Facebook discussion board on Film Weekly Fans. Tell me, what symbol most associated with the Black Power movement in the US was adopted by the Northern Soul movement? Easy. Last entries to us, please, by Tuesday, the 7th of September. Oh, and they're signed copies, signed by Martin Compton himself and director Shimmy Marcus. You got to get them. Spreading his talcum powder on the floor for extra glide. And joining me is Zan Brooks, the Guardian's answer to Northern Soul. You're more of a Southern funk, aren't you, though?
I always thought I was more of a kind of pale one indie boy, but maybe as I get older, I'll kind of adapt.
Get some Northern Soul in. A couple of Dexys Midnight Runners, little sports bag and a towel. Zan Brooks, lovely to see you this week. You're joining me to review Certified Copy. We'll look at Bonded by Blood. Then we'll have Dinner for Schmucks. Then you can tell me about The Last Exorcist. And I will tell you about Cherry Tree Lane. So we run the gamut of films from British gangsters to Tuscan villages, which is where we'll start with Juliette Binoche, being directed by Abbas Kiarostami for only his second foray outside of Iran to make a movie. Do you remember his first?
No, you've really put me on the spot there. Mm. It's not Weekend at Bernie's.
I'd love to have seen that one, though. No, he did... do you remember the triptych called Tickets? Which,
oh, yes, of course.
Olmi did one, and Ken Loach did another, and Kiarostami did one. Sort of half. So it's not a full feature, but this...
Well, that was a trick question then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I like to keep you on your toes, especially your northern-souled toes. This is Certified Copy. It played at Cannes this year, for which Juliette Binoche won the Best Actress Award. Here she plays a Tuscan antiques dealer, showing round an English writer who she's just met for the first time. But they're already lapsing into pretending that they've got a relationship going.
Are you always open on Sundays?
No, usually it's closed, but I thought it'd be a convenient place for us to meet, and I didn't give a time so you could come any time you liked. Yeah. Sorry, I have a hair in my nose with the cat. So you think...
I think we should get some fresh air, don't you? I mean, you have a lovely shop, but it's such a nice day. Perhaps we could go out. And,
sure.
And your invitation didn't say anything about antique shops, really, did it?
No, I thought we'd just go, and I was going to help you shop. And
William Schimmel and Juliette Binoche there in Abbas Kiarostami's Certified Copy. It's a kind of a rom-com, this, Zan, but it's been described as Before Sunset for people with PhDs in semiotics. Is that about fair?
I think that's probably a pretty fair summation. You're saying that they're pretending to be a married couple, but even that, you're not 100% sure that they're pretending. What are they pretending?
I don't know.
I mean, on the face of it, she's an antiques dealer, he's an art historian. They drive around, and then a cafe owner imagines that they're married, and they at first accept and then furnish this misconception, and then begin playing a role where they've been married for 15 years, and the marriage is on the rocks, and they're arguing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're wondering if maybe they really are married, and that this role play is basically what all married couples do.
Yes, I mean, I'm sure that's presumably the thesis.
I think that's the thesis.
There's the moment the cafe owner sort of says, oh, your husband's like this. And there's no moment where she goes, oh, that's a good idea. Let's have some fun with it. And they both kind of end up saying, well, that's all right. Let's play this game. I don't know you. Maybe I do know. But it is, he's lecturing in this Italian town about what's real and what's fake and what's authentic.
Yes.
And is fake more valuable than authentic? And how do you tell the difference?
How do you tell the difference? I mean, I think that is the main message, if there is a message of this film, is that we all play act our our lives for the benefit of ourselves and the people around us, and that it's all a fiction. It's all, the world is a stage.
Yes. And is, so is marriage also a fictive construct?
I think it probably is. I think that's what it's saying. But that doesn't make it any less real and any less painful or beautiful.
It's interesting, too, that William Schimmel, who plays the gentleman there, an Englishman, sort of something of Trevor Eve about him, if you
yeah,
ask
he
me.
Does, doesn't he?
He's an opera singer by trade, better known in that area. This is his first sort of acting role. He's obviously not, I don't think he's a brilliant actor at all. In fact,
I don't
he's,
think
he's
he
a non-actor, really.
He's a very uncomfortable actor, and I'm sure that's why Keir Starmer picked him.
Because you've
this
got
role.
Her, who is a consummate actor, bringing out all the tricks of the trade. It's almost a tour de force performance. She laughs, she cries, she's flirty, she's strong, she puts makeup on into the camera lens.
Whereas he just looks kind of bemused and irritable a lot of the time.
So do you think it was about, here's a lot of acting and here's non-acting, which one is more real?
It's not quite non-acting, though, because he has a couple of moments where he has to explode in rage. There's a scene in the restaurant where he gets very, very angry, and you're thinking, you're doing this very badly.
Yeah.
This is a very unconvincing performance of somebody getting angry. But then you're thinking, but is this meant to be unconvincing? Is he then playing a role that he's getting angry? So there's all these sort of weird little levels of reality that I'm sure Keir Starmer was aware of,
yes,
and was playing with. And I'm sure it's all entirely intentional. But at the same time, it does mean that you're rattled around a little bit between the consummate actor of Binoche and this sort of fumbling amateur.
In context, his last film, Shirin, had a film, a Persian love story, which actually just focused on the people watching this film. It was just a selection of faces. You heard the whole
were
movie
we in
playing
there?
Out. No, Juliette Binoche was there.
Right.
You would have been sort of seen at the back, snoring.
Just, yeah.
Well, Cosmo Landisman of the Sunday Times had left
about
15 minutes in.
Yeah. To the loo.
Yeah, it's a very long loo break. have I lifted the lid on the dark world of the critic?
Nobody wants to lift that lid.
So he is very interested in reactions and people watching what happens when people are watching fiction. Interestingly enough, the guy who kind of helped him write this, Jean-Claude Carrière, one of the great script writers, has a walk-on cameo in this film. He plays a tourist who kind of is in front of the well.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was Carrière.
Ah.
Yeah, uncredited cameo. So not only you've got a great screenwriter within the fiction as well.
You've also got a play of different languages, that this was initially going to be filmed entirely in English, but they needed the French funding, so they had to quickly turn a lot of the dialogue into French.
Right.
So there's all these different levels of intimacy and distance and different languages, and an Iranian director in Tuscany with a French actress and a British actor.
Yeah. And she, of course, switches sort of effortlessly between all three, Italian as well.
Yeah. It's a curate's egg, isn't it, this film?
It is. I rather like it for its playfulness.
I think it's very interesting.
It's classy and clever, but will it be a hit? I don't know. And they're talking of Juliette Binoche for Oscars. Is that possible?
No, not with this, I don't think.
Not if she kind of gets up and saying keep releasing Iranian filmmakers.
Yeah, they won't like that.
That no.
Yeah, and that 9/11 was a hoax perpetrated by Bush.
Oh, yeah, she said that here on Film Weekly as well. That's a bit weird. Anyway,
play well.
Very good actress. Certified Copy by Abbas Kiarostami, our lead film this week. So we're going to change tack, I think, quite swiftly and quite abruptly. We're going to go to Essex. We're going to go for Bonded by Blood. They are driven by greed, these people. It tells the story of what happened when three people were found dead in a Range Rover in a field in Essex in 1995.
And this is Darren Nichols.
Young man?
He clocked you coming in. Said you look like a big cunt from an Arnold Schwarzenegger film.
He did.
No.
Come here, let's have a look at you. I can look at you. Maybe we should get you in the gym, bump you up a little bit. Make you look like a man instead of a little boy, eh? Anything beats sitting in that cell wanking your life away. It'd make you go blind. He's all right, isn't he?
Yeah, he's good, lad. Good boy.
A true story, apparently, which has actually been the basis of a film before, Essex Boys.
Two films before.
Two films.
Essex Boys and Rise of the Foot Soldier.
Oh, was that
yeah,
about this?
Yeah, that was that. This is
I saw Rise of the Foot Soldier. I didn't know what that was about.
This is like the kind of the Kennedy assassination for a certain breed of British filmmaker. It's the crime that they just keep coming back to, the Rettenden Range Rover murders.
That's right. Which at the time I didn't know
at all. I only know it through the movies.
Yeah.
And through quite bad movies.
I thought Essex Boys was quite good, actually, written by Terry Winds. I thought that had a certain...
That was all right.
It had Tom Wilkinson and Sean Pertwee in it.
But they keep going back to this crime scene. There's like nothing. Surely there's nothing new they can find.
Well, you say that. Mm. But you see there may be some revisionism going on. We're not going to even talk about the film. It sort of sallies our mouths. We've mentioned it. It's one of the most vicious and foul-mouthed films I've ever witnessed.
Yes, I guess it is. There's a lot of effing and blinding. And seeing. A lot of seeing.
There's some very funny lines in it, I have to say.
Were there?
There's a lot of Charlie, there's a lot of pills, there's a lot of this, there's a lot of that, bish, bash, bosh. You know, I couldn't believe it, because Tam Hassan, his agent sort of says, would you get him on the podcast? Would you have him
He'd
on?
He'd be good,
know,
get him on.
Talk him on, you do him in The Observer, you know, this is a big, big actor.
Yeah.
And I would do that. But then I'd see him go and do a film like Bonded by Blood, in which he kind of, you know, does a geezer, burns him with cigarettes, leaves him on his missus's lawn, pisses all over him,
yeah,
and gets in the car. And I think, you know what?
It's not.
I can't really culturally reappraise you if you're going to do
it's
that.
It's not Marlon Brando, is
it's
it?
It's not, is it? Bonded by Blood, if you must. Dinner for Schmucks, Zan, a remake of François Weber's film Dîner de Cons, which was a very big hit for sort of French crossover language. This is now being remade, executive produced by Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it?
He was supposed to be in it, but he isn't.
I bet he was playing the Jermaine Clement role.
Or I think
originally
so.
He was probably going to do that. He was the pretentious modern artist who strips naked and runs through the forest.
In cloven hooves.
Yeah, gives birth to zebras.
He's the guy from Flight of the Conchords.
Yes, and
do you know what Flight of the Conchords is?
I do, and I really like Flight of the Conchords. I like it a lot, and I think he's brilliant. I like Jermaine Clement. I like Steve Carell. I quite like David Walliams, and they're all in this, and they're all quite bad.
Let's have a listen to Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords, playing Kieran, the pretentious artist, and telling them how his process works.
Am I going to make love with Christina and Monique tonight? Yeah, hell yes. Guilty. You caught me out. Yeah, but only because it's part of my process.
Your process?
There are two things in this world. Wonderful. Visceral. Sexy sex. And death. Horrible, boring death. Now I'm going to go off and have some sex with these girls before I die.
Go ahead.
If you guys want to join, that's cool. But don't look at me in the eye, it puts me off.
Jermaine Clement in Dinner for Schmucks. It's not actually about him, though. It is actually about Paul Rudd, who has to take an idiot to dinner to kind of get high up in his kind of stockbroking firm. And he wants to take, and he meets Steve Carell, who is a sort of play. He kind of makes tableaus with formaldehyded and taxidermed mice.
Yes, which in itself is funny. And there's some nice little sight gags of his art, like, you know, The Last Supper with all the
mice. He's got a book of mousepieces.
Yes.
That was quite funny.
Yeah. Munch's Scream with mouse.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, all of that is quite nice. And these are all expert comic actors. There was something a bit wrong with this, though.
Where did
was
it go?
Flat
so
as a pancake,
hard, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean
maybe it, French farce doesn't really translate, and it certainly didn't have any bite to it.
You forget it's called Dinner for Schmucks. You're like, when's the dinner happening?
Yeah.
Where's the dinner?
I know, being postponed.
It's like an hour and a half in before any hint of dinner being served.
Well, he keeps showing up and saying, the dinner's tonight, the Steve Carell character, and Paul Rudd keeps saying, no, it's tomorrow. And you think, you know, let it be tonight. Let's just start it now.
And then they go and meet David Walliams, who plays like an Austrian art collector, Swiss
billionaire.
Billionaire Martin Hoyer. It was all right. He's very creepy, David Walliams, I must say.
He's meant to be creepy.
I know, it's really weird in this. And then the Lucy Punch, British actress, she camped up as some kind of stalker.
Yeah.
It's the humour is kind of slightly odd. I mean, stalkers, kind of funny as far as they go. I don't know, idiot, savant, autistic, learning impaired. Yeah. They're funny, really not very far as they go. Steve Carell clearly is a
problem. Well, if you're
going to
do it black as tar.
Yeah.
Go for it. And this doesn't. This has a terrible sort of kind of lachrymose sentimentality where these people are just as good as you and I. Maybe they can teach us something about our lives. And it cops out at a very early stage. And so then it's got nowhere really to go.
Yeah. And Bruce Greenwood, I like, as the kind of ruthless kind of head of the firm. But it's not about the corporate America's kind of cruelty, which
it's
was
a buddy
the French
movie,
film.
Really.
Exactly, which is really where the French one was about, you know, he was a dentist. It wasn't even that wealthy. So I don't know what this film was trying to be. And it certainly has sort of missed the target. And many targets it has. And it certainly seemed to miss them all for me. I don't even know why it's called Dinner for Schmucks anymore. I think the schmucks were the people that made it.
That's why I called you.
And you don't know.
I woke up, she was standing here.
Now.
Stay back, okay?
I'm not getting any answer.
Okay, it's gonna be okay, honey. Now. Oh, God.
Now we need to get her to a hospital.
Zan, you have seen the film that is top of the US box office.
Aren't I privileged?
Last Exorcist. Can you tell me about this? I didn't go and see it. I heard it was really gory. And is this The Exorcist as in, you know, William Friedkin, that Exorcist? This is the last one of him?
It kind of is, in a way.
Is it the same guy?
It's about a disillusioned preacher in Louisiana who lets a documentary crew follow him around to basically expose the myth of exorcism. It's his way of basically kind of letting the light in and showing what a charlatan he is.
Ah.
It's shot in the sort of mockumentary style that has been obviously done before with, you know, obviously with Blair Witch, but more recently with Paranormal Activity. He ventures into the Louisiana backwaters where he meets a girl who's supposedly demonically possessed, but he very much doubts this.
How would you know in the Louisiana backwaters?
They're all a little bit odd, aren't
frankly.
They? And then, of course, things get darker and more disturbing.
It's produced by Eli Roth.
It is produced by Eli Roth, but it's a better film, I think, than most of Eli Roth's films. It's actually very good. It's very good and very creepy and has this slow, stealthy build-up of tension for about the first hour. And then it kind of implodes in a very annoying way. It gets sort of hysterical and loses pretty much all of the greatness that it's
built
up.
Oh, no, that is a shame.
It is a
so
shame.
So it kind of cops that, because the 70s horror used to kind of be all about the build-up, and then it was kind
I
of...
I think someone got cold feet and just tried to sort of hotwire it at the last minute.
Right, so we like to let's give the audience what we think
it goes
they
a little
want.
Bit M. Night Shyamalan without trying to give too much away.
Can I tell you about Cherry
Please
Tree
do.
Lane? It's a British film about hoodies who terrorise a middle-class couple. Paul Andrew Williams directs it, who made London to Brighton, which I think is a brilliant
Which is a brilliant film, and then he did a very bad film after that.
Yeah, with Jennifer Ellison and... Yeah. Andy Serkis, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of Funny Games, but set in sort of, obviously, sort of a nice suburb of London. Cherry Tree Lane is the kind of middle-class enclave.
Sounds all right.
The two, a husband and wife, are kind of bickering after a day at work, and you think, well, they're not very nice anyway. So the door goes, and they're looking for their son, Sebastian, and then suddenly it goes, ooh, whack, boom, and suddenly these hoodies explode into the living room, and they hold them hostage, basically.
It sounds like a Daily Mail scare story put on the screen.
It is basically a morally panicked film, rather hysterical, not without its kind of intelligence, and not without its kind of... It slightly reminded me of that Great Ecstasy of Robert Carmichael.
Oh, yeah, but I didn't like that.
That Danny Dyer was in.
He was in.
That has a bit of... It was horrible, that film as well, and also a bit pretentious. This film isn't pretentious, it's quite stylish. The music is by Uncle. It's kind of well done. It's very unpleasant for no real reason, and that's a slight problem. But I do think he's quite an interesting filmmaker. He just needs to kind of get his thesis in out of a twist.
It seems that he's more of a talented director as opposed to a talented writer, and maybe needs to kind of develop that.
Yes, let's do that. Paul, if you're listening, go and develop that. Cherry Tree Lane. Zan Brooks, lovely to see you. We're going off to Venice for next week.
Isn't that great?
I think it should be great.
What are we going to do? Should we go and see some films? Or should we just hang out?
Let's hang and eat those nice little kind of fritty fish.
I want to eat so much ice cream that I'm going to need two seats on the way home.
Really? Well, I'll get you two microphones for next week's Film Weekly from Venice. Zan Brooks, molto grazie. See you then.
Thank you.
Secret Cinema has, in the last few years, started to reinvent how we watch classic films, re-injecting a kind of magic and mystery back into the experience of watching the silver screen. It's quite an achievement, and its ambitions are growing ever further. So I'm delighted to welcome Secret Cinema's founder, Fabian Riggle, to Film Weekly. Welcome. Lovely to see you.
Good to see you.
Now, you started Secret Cinema. I mean, it was almost a whisper when it started. I remember the very first one. How long ago was that?
2007. So it was just towards the end of 2007, November 2007.
So what was the idea? I mean, because you also do future shorts well, and you've been kind of working on that. But the idea was actually to just sort of say, well, let's say we're going to have an event and see what film fans are like. Do they just come if they know it might be a good film? They're going to have to trust you programming it. They don't know what it is, do they?
Well, I think future shorts kind of started it, and the short film isn't sort of a mass medium. It's something that's kind of, you know, that we see at festivals, and that was the idea of starting future shorts, was to create a wider audience. And so we mixed live music and DJs and had photography exhibitions at events, and that created this new audience. And off the back of that, we set up Secret Cinema. And the concept really is that, you know, if you can create an environment and an experience, it doesn't matter where it is or what it is, because at the end of the day, that's what they're going to remember more than anything. You know, if you go to the cinema in your local view and, you know, there's a sort of, I don't know, a protest or someone falls down, you know, that's the biggest experience. That's a strange way of describing it, actually. But, you know, if something happens different, then I guess you remember the experience a bit more.
Yeah, so. That was the night that we did this or whatever. Sometimes you remember the meal afterwards or before, the date you remember rather than the movie itself.
Yeah.
So where was that first?
The first one was Under the Arches. It's Under the Arches in London Bridge.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was a very good gathering of people. But it was, how many people turned up? Like 150, 200?
No, it was 400.
Okay.
And yeah, we were really, you know, because initially Secret Cinema was an idea which I was imagining for it to stay quite underground and hopefully we still kept the spirit of that. But yeah, it was 400 people.
Yeah, now your last Secret Cinema, the most recent one, was up at the Edinburgh Film Festival.
No, the last Secret Cinema was Blade Runner.
Oh, right.
Which was in Canary Wharf.
Canary Wharf, which had an audience of?
7,000.
You see? You've grown.
Yeah, it seems that we've grown. Yes.
And, you know, did people know that was going to be Blade Runner? Because now it's all, it's kind of, it reminds me of the kind of raves back in the 90s when you just kind of ring someone and say, oh, it'd be a field out by the, you know, yeah, Basildon somewhere. This is kind of like that, isn't it?
Well, people don't know what they're going to see. Yeah, I think it is, you know, it's a happening in that people don't know where it is or what they're going to see, and they're very much trusting that they're going to enjoy it. Yeah, it's very much like that. And
what have you shown so far?
So the first was Paranoid Park, which was obviously, you know, Gus Van Sant's film, and we created this like skate park underneath London Bridge, which was fun. But we wanted to really, you know, not get the audience to think they're going to get that kind of film each time. So the next one we did was Funny Face at the Royal Academy of Art, which we did at London Fashion Week. So it was kind of fun. We did it in the middle of London Fashion Week.
Lovely.
And then we went on and did If at Dulwich College. After that,
because it was filmed at...
It was shot in Cheltenham College, yeah. But it was great because we got the audience to sing a hymn and we had a headmaster, you know, welcoming them through the door. So it was almost like they were going into this very sort of traditional British school. And then after that, we did Night at the Opera at Hackney Empire.
Which was hilarious.
Which was fun. It was kind of a film that obviously, you know, the Marx Brothers... Not many people had seen the film, and I think it was great to get 1,000 people watching, and that was, you know, that was great. And
did you do Anvil as well?
And we did Anvil at Shepherd's Bush Empire, and we got them to play afterwards, and we hid them behind the stage. And what was nice about it is, it's such an emotional film already, and so after the film was finished, everyone was feeling quite emotional, and then we hid them and put them into the backstage area, and then we put the main singer Lips onto the balcony with a guitar. And it was amazing to see these, you know, the people I don't think who'd, you know, necessarily into heavy metal, you know, really dancing, going crazy.
Yeah, it took the roof off that one. I guess what you've done, and I don't know if this was the idea or if it was born of that, is tap into the stuff that has been missing from certainly the British cinema scene, which are those kind of rep cinemas, are those late night kind of clubs, the Scala type thing, which people still hark back to. The world has become so multiplexed and sanitised that cinema going has been, you know, the exhibitors, distributors, they need to find new ways of kind of making people get out off their sofas. We've all got, you know, big plasma screens at home and Blu-ray and high definition, you know, that home entertainment gets more and more kind of, you know, sharp and kind of a higher quality. How do you get people to go out and watch films?
People want to feel like they can go to a place and be with other people watching a film, and perhaps, you know, it's not so awkward to actually talk to the person next to you. People want to go back to the picture palaces. They want to go back to the old theatres. They want a feeling of epic and magic. And I think that's the same for the British film industry. I think we should find another filmmaker like the one that we're representing with this secret film this weekend.
Yes, so I was just going to ask you, so where it's leading to, you've got a secret film, which obviously you can't tell me about or tell anyone, but you need to let people know that it's happening. So how do you maintain cinema's
secret? It's
happening on Friday.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we have a sort of narrative on Facebook and Twitter where we sort of give clues every few days. And it seems to be that, you know, the clue, you know, it's happening this Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's our biggest event yet. We've sold 12,000 tickets.
You can't tell us where.
Yeah, I can tell you where, because the clue has come out. Essentially, the meeting point is in Alexandra Palace Park.
In North London.
Yes.
And you go there, and what's going to happen?
Well, that's something that I'm not going to really divulge, except for that the audience have been grouped up into different tribes, north, south, east and west. They have their tribal colours and have been asked to turn up in full Bedouin attire and to bring a drum or a musical instrument if they have one.
Lovely. Well, we heartily approve of Secret Cinema, bringing new films to the masses in a new and exciting way. It's better than, getting a pick and mix and sitting there and tutting latecomers at your local View. Fabian Riggle, lovely to see you. Thank you very much. Best of luck with the future of Secret Cinema as well, and the future of shorts as well, which you've been pushing. And nice to have you on Film Weekly.
Thank you very much, Jason. So come let me protect
you. That's it for this week. The music you've been listening to in this week's podcast is, of course, from the Soul Boy soundtrack. So go to our Facebook fan page, Film Weekly Fans, and try and win a copy of it. So many stompers on there. It's unbelievable. And don't think I've forgotten, last week we ran a competition for 5 very fetching Lisbeth Salander t-shirts as we interviewed the girl who played with fire, director Daniel Alfredson. We asked you to simply post on our Facebook Film Weekly fans wall, and lots of you did. Names out of the hat are Michael Chin and Terry J. Dillon, who want extra larges, and Callie Clark, Emma Violet Phelan, and Francis Ipson, who want a selection of smalls and mediums. Congratulations to you guys. You're going to look very fetching. Next week, I'll be in Venice reporting from the festival, so pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer for a little taster of what's going on in the Lido. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. Keep on grooving, Northern Soul style, of course.